NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This weekend, news broke in Tucson, Arizona, that had many of us feeling dazed, disgusted, and in disbelief. 22-year-old Jared Loughner opened fire at an event held by Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. Giffords was critically injured. 6 others were killed, including a 9-year-old girl, and 13 more were badly wounded. All over the country, people shook their heads and asked those unanswerable questions. What would drive someone to the point where they would do this, take so many innocent lives? Is it the product of a bad childhood, the overstimulation of violent movies, television, and video games, or a tendency that may be inherent to all of us? We ask the same questions when we encounter other acts of violence, too. Many are horrified when they hear of torture and beatings. Some have campaigned against capital and corporal punishment. Yet millions of sports fans who would never hurt someone gather around their TVs to watch games like boxing, football, and hockey, which seem to embrace a sort of controlled violence. Also, some of us enjoy movies and video games in which people are imaginarily killed or beaten. And it could be argued that some forms of violence are helpful, freeing the world from the Nazis, for example, or even much earlier, the war for American independence. So that's what we're looking at today on the Socrates Exchange. We're asking, are human beings violent by nature? Are we born with violent tendencies, or is it something that's learned? Can violence ever be for the common good? Or could we imagine a world completely devoid of violence? Also, how do we define violence? A war? A slap? An insult? And can humans be considered violent or destructive to nature? Call in the exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. The Socrates Exchange is funded in part by the New Hampshire Humanities Council. And today, our philosopher is Ed McGushin, an associate professor of philosophy at St. Anselm College. And welcome back, Ed. Nice to see you.
Hi, Laura.
Well, lay out for us, if you could, Ed, some of the central questions that come up as we look at this question. Are human beings violent by nature?
Well, there are many, many questions here, and they're very difficult ones. I mean, the question about human nature, there's already a kind of ambiguity in the notion of human nature. Is this a fundamental urge or tendency? Does this mean that human beings could never eliminate that violent tendency? One of the earliest philosophers in the Western tradition, Heraclitus, argued that war is the father of all things. That suggests something even beyond human nature, but that nature, life in general, has an inherent violence to it that is necessary and maybe even productive. Other philosophers have disagreed and said that violence is a social construct or the result of human free will, and that it could be somehow reduced or maybe even eliminated. So those are just some of the questions that come up. And of course, the other side of that is, how do we define violence? Is violence always something that is physical? Is violence something that is psychological or symbolic or spiritual? Is violence something that we can commit against animals, against the environment? Can we do it unintentionally? And finally, is violence always a bad thing? So those are just some of the questions, and I'm sure there are many others that are going to come up.
Lots to dig into with our listeners. And let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. I want to remind you that this is a little different from a regular exchange program. Ed McGushin's role is not to answer this question. It's to explore it with you through the Socratic method of asking more questions. So when you call, please stay on the line with us for a while and have a dialogue with Ed and me about this. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. The question this month on the Socrates Exchange is, are human beings violent by nature? And as Ed said, there are lots of questions. What is human nature? How do we define violence? Could violence ever be eliminated completely? And is violence a social construct? Give us a call. Let's hear from you. Get Socratic with us this hour, 1-800-892-6477. And as we examine this question of, are human beings violent by nature, our executive producer, Keith Shields, spoke with Ted Kirkpatrick. He's an associate dean at UNH and a clinical professor of sociology there. In his courses, he studies this question of whether violence is innate.
People often ask me as a homicide researcher why people do what they do. And a rejoinder to that question almost always involves whether or not human beings are born or innately good, evil, or neutral. Those three assumptions about human behavior are largely untestable. Still, in the advanced state of social behavioral science in 2011, we're really not able to address those empirically. Knowing what I know, you could give me almost anybody, even Mother Teresa for that matter, and if I could control all of the variables from her birth through her early childhood and into adulthood, you could probably get even Mother Teresa to do something very bad. So the riddle of homicide is a very complicated one, but I think that we do know that there are certain things that increase the likelihood that somebody's going to behave in violent ways. And I think that what we should do as a wider society is pay heed to those and figure out ways in which we can ameliorate those likely causes to have less criminal violence in the wider society. There are remaining puzzles in homicide studies. For example, the United States typically has had a much higher homicide rate than has, say, Canada or the United Kingdom. Now, why is that? Is it because there are more evil people in the United States than there are in Canada? Probably not. Is it because there's some difference in biochemistry between Canadians and Americans? Probably not. So it points homicide researchers to look towards structural variables like economic factors, cultural factors, sociopolitical factors that might be more salient in helping us understand that equation. There are also other variables at play. For example, we know that more younger people are involved in violent acts than are older people. We know that men commit murder disproportionately at a higher rate than do women. Why is that? Those are the sorts of puzzles that I think a lot of social and behavioral scientists are preoccupied with currently. Can one live completely a nonviolent life? We have ready examples of people who commit themselves to peaceful coexistence with their peers. Have they completely been free of violent acts? I'm not so sure. Some sociologists argue that good and evil are codependent terms. You can't have good without evil and vice versa. So, for example, if you go to a monastery, these pious people who devote themselves to pious ways, inevitably there are people who share that community would regard as, gee, that person's very aggressive. So I think it is helpful when we look at human affairs to remember that there is a relativity factor. Clearly, we all agree that there are things like robbery, rape, murder that are disvalued behavior and they disrupt our social lives. But apart from those egregious acts, what level of aggressive behavior can we tolerate? And clearly in the United States, there are some people that argue that we're much more violent or aggressive as a culture than are others. And all one needs to do is look at the way that we describe our market economy. One company has to beat another and put it out of business. In our professional athletics that we watch endlessly on television, we love football, we love ice hockey. But even in those arenas where those things are socially acceptable, there are limits. Many hockey fans love to see fights on the ice, but they wouldn't want to see two players taking their hockey sticks to each other's faces.
That conversation with UNH Associate Dean and Professor Ted Kirkpatrick was produced by Exchange Executive Producer Keith Shields. Our number for you to join us on the Socrates Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Again, what do you think about this question? Are human beings violent by nature? Is modern society pushing an increase in violent behavior? Or is society protecting us from even more violence? Ed McGushin, let's go to the phones again. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. First up on the Socrates Exchange is Ben in Henniker. Hi, Ben. Thanks for joining us. What do you think about this question?
Thank you for taking my call. I was just interested in looking at the culture issues and as far as well, the United States, I was reading an article just last week that in the state of Georgia, one out of every 13 people is either in prison or jail on probation or parole, and that's by far, you know, the highest rate anywhere in the world. And I just wonder if you look at also the conditions that are in existence in that jail. When you have one in every 13 people being tortured, you know, what is that going to do when they then reintegrate into society, but, you know, just them more and more violence?
Thanks, Ben. I have a question for you about this. That's very interesting. I mean, people would say that modern societies have reduced violence overall over time, historically, from times when violence was committed very regularly. And now, you know, a lot of us live lives where we're not going to be exposed to extreme violence maybe in our entire lives. But is that premised on a imprisonment at a vast scale? There's something like, I haven't seen the most recent numbers, but nearly 2 million people in the prison system in one form or another in this country right now. Is that prison? Are you suggesting that imprisonment is inherently violent?
No, I'm suggesting that imprisonment in the United States is inherently violent the way that it's currently practiced. I mean, if you look at our prison system, it's regarded widely as being as brutal as many of the prisons in the third world. And yet, I understand that there's, you know, the common perception that, you know, we live in a just world, and if someone's in prison, then, you know, they're guilty and, you know, they have all sorts of ethical problems. But oftentimes, it's just the poor, the disadvantaged, you know, if you look at drug violations, we send minorities to prison at a rate that's 20 times that of, you know, the rest of the people.
Right. Ben, lots of questions, and thanks for getting Socratic with us, and I appreciate your call. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. The question we're asking this hour, are human beings violent by nature? And Ed McGushin, I'll wrap up this segment with a quote from one of our postings. Jean says, my students and I are wrapping up our discussion of Lord of the Flies. The issue of innate violence is one we've discussed extensively. She says her students start with the idea that violence is an external factor, but end with the idea that we as humans are naturally violent. Ben, thanks again for being with us on the Socrates Exchange. More of your calls coming up.
It's 9:19. Good morning. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Tracy Banks Saab in Concord. Introducing the new redesigned Saab 9.5 sedan, a turbocharged luxury sports sedan for the independent thinker. TracyBanksSaab.com. Saab, move your mind. And from Vineyard Brands, importers of La Vie Ferme wines from the southern Rhone Valley of France, available in New Hampshire State liquor stores. VineyardBrands.com. More on the Socrates Exchange on NHPR and at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, healthcare reform and the economy. New Hampshire weather, winter storm watch in effect from late Tuesday night through Wednesday evening for Hillsborough and Cheshire counties. For today, partly to mostly sunny statewide, there's a 50% chance of snow showers in Coos County. Today's highs mid to upper 20s statewide. Mostly clear tonight, low single numbers north to mid-teens south. For tomorrow, mostly sunny for the entire state. Highs will be in the 20s. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, it's our Socrates Exchange, where once a month we examine one question using the Socratic method of asking more questions. And this month, that question is, are human beings violent by nature? Let's get your thoughts on this question. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Ed McGushin is our co-host and our philosopher today. He's a professor of philosophy at St. Anselm College. And Ed, let's go right back to our callers. John's up from New London. Hi, John, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I definitely think humans are inherently violent by nature. If you look at even the way children play with each other, real small children, you know, there's a certain element of violence that they all exhibit. Not intentional, but they definitely do exhibit it.
Thanks, John. Yeah, I mean, you know, I've got a 2-year-old at home, and I see him play, and there's a rowdiness there. I wonder, could you define what you mean, though, when you say that they're violent by nature? Do you mean that there's some sort of inner instinctive impulse towards that, or that there's some sort of urge or pleasure that one takes in that? Could you expand on that a bit?
Actually, I think not taking pleasure from violence is more learned. I watch both. I have a 2- and a 4-year-old, and I watch them both. You know, my daughter, who's 4, it took a long time for her to understand that when you hurt somebody, it's really not a funny thing, even in the context of play. And my son, who's 2, he doesn't understand. He runs around the house saying, "I'm going to shoot you. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that." And I used to be a Chicago cop. I've seen violence firsthand in horrible, horrible ways. But I keep trying to explain to him that shooting isn't good and hitting isn't good and kicking isn't good. But they still, both of them, still take a certain joy in, you know, jumping on daddy with their knees.
John, let me ask you this, too.
Yep.
Do you think that the sort of tendency to engage in rowdy or destructive or violent behaviors is more fundamental in them than their urge towards love, compassion, cooperation? Because I also see with children, you know, a real desire to make people happy, to do things, you know, to give hugs or to, you know what I'm saying, that there's also another urge that's I'm wondering if it's equally fundamental to this urge to, you know, knock things over and kick things or push things. What do you think about that?
I think it's equal, at least equal, maybe even a little stronger. In most children, I think it's actually a little stronger, which is why most kids don't grow up to be violent criminals.
So, John, let me ask you a question, if I could. So is this something, then, that children learn as soon as they come out of the womb from their parents, or is this something that they're going to do no matter what?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure. I think they're going to do it no matter what, because when, you know, at least with my kids, you make a reaction, and they find the reaction funny. So they're kind of reacting to the reaction that you give them, which to them is enjoyable.
Well, John, thanks a lot for calling in. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. 1-800-892-6477. Join Ed McGushin and me on the Socrates Exchange today. The question we're asking is, are human beings violent by nature? And George is calling from Concord. Hi, George. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Laura. Good morning, Ed. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Good, thanks. I think that children are born naturally selfish, and that they want what they want, and then they go through this period by nurturing and parenting where they learn to either control those impulses or release them in their environment, their particularly early childhood training, and later their education, and sometimes their circumstances impact the way that they express their selfishness. And you quoted a statistic about the United States being having a lot more homicides than many countries. And I think principally the reason for that is because we have more, in American culture, there's typically a lot more access to weapons that enable, you know, impetuous or spontaneous acts of selfishness to be expressed in more violent ways.
Thanks, George. That's really interesting. You seem to be connecting violent, let's just look at violent behaviors, to kind of inherent selfishness. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
So it's out of a kind of self-interest or egocentrism that one is more likely to or inclined to engage in violence. So is there any way then, or how would one go about mitigating that? Or why? Let me change that question a little bit. Why would there be a connection between selfishness and violent behavior, do you think?
Well, you know, I'm not in your profession, but I tend to believe that most murders have a selfish motive. Would you agree?
I don't know.
their rage, their jealousy, their greed, their the motive for almost all violence is selfish. So it's a response. It's a appropriate or inappropriate expression of the selfishness that brings them to the act.
That's interesting. You know? Yeah, George, I wonder, I mean, is it Selfishness, sometimes you might think of somebody having an idea of what they might gain from an activity. They do it because they see some advantage to themselves in it. But a lot of violence might be a little more primal or basic than that, an expression of rage without any sense of consequence or gain from it. Is that still selfish, or is that something a little harder to get a hold of?
I think it's selfishness on steroids. You take a look at why do people have rage? People have rage because they perceive an offense. They have an offense because they believe that people have done something against them. And they wanted something, they didn't receive it, whether it's affection, whether it's money. They want something. It's a selfish motive. Then they want retribution. Maybe even justice occasionally, but they want retribution. That motive is selfish. You did this to me, therefore I'm going to do it to you. It's a selfish motive. I want revenge. And if you take a child, and particularly in their very early formative years, and you help them understand what's appropriate expressions of their desire, and you that is consistently reinforced as they grow older, I think that you mitigate most of the issues that people are going to later have. Now, some people, are organically harmed at birth, disease, whatever. And those folks, I think, fit in a different category.
You're talking about mental illness, George.
Correct. Yes, have a mental illness.
Well, and George, you got a career in philosophy. Is violence born of selfishness? It's a great question. Thank you for calling in. I appreciate it.
Thanks
a lot, George.
And up next is Ray in Nashua. Ray, go ahead. You're on the Socrates Exchange. Welcome. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, good morning, Laura. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick comment that I believe that all living organisms are violent by their nature because in order to survive, all living organisms have to consume. We have to kill in order to survive. And so I think that all living organisms on Earth have some... I think violence is necessary, if not crucial, because it leads to continued existence. But I also think that humans have come to a point where we understand that necessary violence, like killing of animals to consume for food to continue to survive, is okay. But we've come to a point where unnecessary violence, killing for the sake of killing, homicides, that type of thing, has become rightly so looked down upon in society. But I also believe that human beings can be trained to be violent. Just look at our armed forces. I served as a Marine for 8 years, and so I was trained to be violent towards other humans. But at the same time, like I said, I do believe that violence is inherent in all living organisms because we have to kill and we have to consume in order to survive.
Ray, do you think it's a if violence is... But by the way, thanks for that thought. I mean, it's true. We have to kill and we have to eat and we have to, use the natural resources and transform them into goods that we can consume. So then at what point do we draw the line then between violence that might be justified or necessary and violence that is unjustified and unnecessary? And why would we draw that line?
Well, I guess, like I just said, the necessary violence is the violence only needed to survive. The unnecessary violence would be homicides or, the serial murderers. That type of violence is obviously not necessary, and it's just plain wrong. We've come to that point, I think, as a society where we understand that. And I think we've been there for quite a while where we understand that unnecessary violence is wrong, but that necessary violence is all that's needed for human beings and other organisms, other living organisms to survive. But where you draw the line, that's a tough call. I think it just goes back to if you're looking at a violent act that occurred, you just kind of have to ask, was this violence necessary in order to preserve life in the cases of such as self-defense, or was this violence necessary to survive, like killing animals in order to consume and feed the village, so to speak. But if it's not justified, if it's killing just for the sake of killing, there has to be some beneficial mutual, result from the violence for it to be justified in my point of view.
Hey, Ray, can I ask you a quick question? And you're so right. It is really hard to draw that line. In your earlier point about all living things are violent by nature, we kill in order to survive. If I'm a vegan and I do nothing with animal products, am I sort of off scot-free there?
Well, you're still killing a living organism. Plants are living organisms, whether you might, you know, whether you think they have feelings or they might feel or understand pain or suffering as, you know, the higher cognitive, the more cognitive organisms on Earth do, I think at the end result, you're still killing and you're still consuming a living organism. And so, you know, as much as we might say, well, that's okay because they're just plants, you still have to understand that you're still causing the death and you're still causing violence to a living organism.
All right. Ray, good to hear from you, especially given your experience as a Marine. I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks, Ray. This is the Socrates Exchange. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. The question we're asking this hour is, are human beings violent by nature? Let's get your thoughts. How do we define human nature? How do we define violence? Does society make violence worse, or does it help reduce violence? We'd love your thoughts at 1-800-892-6477. And Ed, let's go next to Sheila in Ringe. Hi, Sheila, you're on the air. Welcome. Sheila in Ringe, are you with us? Okay, Sheila in Ringe is not with us. I hope you call back, Sheila. Let's go next to Cornish, and Leonard's waiting in Cornish. Hi, Leonard, you're on the air. Okay, the phones are feeling Socratic today, asking questions instead of giving us callers. Again, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Let's try Phil in Hanover. Hi, Phil, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine.
Good. Since Ray said a lot of what I was going to say with regard to the orientation of various organisms, I'm going to shift my focus to say that there are really kind of, in all organisms, I think, or at least mammals, there are two motivations for violence. One is eating. Another is perceived threat. So I'm going to focus on the perceived threat idea for a moment. I think that bullying, the more threatened a person feels, I think the more prone to violence of whatever sort, whether that's psychological violence, verbal violence, physical violence, the more a person feels threatened and is fearful, the more prone that person is to try to dominate those around and to employ violence to try to support that that feeling of need for dominance for safety purposes.
Okay, let me ask a question, Phil. Do you think there might be another motivation? I don't know if in all mammals, but maybe in humans, a sense of honor, a sense of inherent worth, so that someone, I mean, maybe this is connected to threat in a way, but it's not a threat to my physical well-being, but it's an insult.
So I do think that part of human nature involves the ego, which is connected with this desire for, need for, or impulse for honor, to seek honor, to protect one's honor. So, sure, I do.
So I guess one reason why I raised that question, Phil, is because it seems like, you know, with advances in technology and advances in markets and economics, we could, at least for human beings, we could really reduce the sort of motivations of eating and perceived threat greatly, and have done so, at least for some people on the planet. But I wonder about this third thing, if it's real. How would one go about addressing or reducing the motivation for that? You know, is that a little harder to get a hold of?
It is harder because I think there are biochemical, especially brain chemistry, issues involved. I think that there are genetic predispositions. I think there's family of origin issues. I think there are real issues in the surrounding environment in the immediate moment. So there are a lot of variables there. What concerns me, I guess, is whether it's for, as you say, honor, or whether it's for survival or perceived threat to safety. Why, if human beings are prone to, I think, greater violence, less perhaps discriminate violence, than other animals. I wonder why we put or allow in our country more weapons to be available for the average person, regardless of that person's momentary orientation of thought or feeling. Why we put weapons in available, make weapons available and legal that can do more violence than a person might otherwise ordinarily do.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling in, Phil. And 1-800-892-6477 is the number. The question this hour in the Socrates Exchange, are human beings violent by nature? And, Ed, let's try Sheila in Ringe again. Hi, Sheila. You there?
Hi. Sorry I got disconnected, and thank you so much for taking my call. I really appreciate that you're doing this program, especially with what's going on right now. It's tragically appropriate. I wanted to talk about the opportunities that we have for learning to choose nonviolent approaches to things. That I've been involved with a program called Alternatives to Violence Project, which teaches nonviolent intervention techniques and in prisons. And also I teach at the Meeting School, where peace studies is a required course. It's one of the few required courses we have here.
Please, I'd like to know what you've learned.
Well, that would take years. But
well, just give us a couple of things that stand out.
Yeah, just that I do agree with many of the other callers that there is some inherent tendency toward violence. But I think that we also, as a society, have reacted to that so much that in the way of choosing violence, both for entertainment as well as for a response to violence, and that we can choose to go the other direction, as Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Thoreau and many others have, and we need to study that. We need to study what their techniques have been, and we also need to practice that so that then when a situation of conflict comes up, then we have those skills, those tools, and those instincts to go in the other direction. And I think that that's something that we can choose as a society to put more focus on. If you want some specifics, I could give you specifics.
Well, actually, Sheila, in the interest of time,
yeah.
I'm going to just... No, you stay with us. Don't hang up, all right? Because we want to give Ed a chance to get Socratic with you and you back at him. So stay on the line. That's fine. And we'll be back in just a moment. Our number here on the Socrates Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Sheila and everyone, keep it right here.
NHPR listeners support the arts in our community.
What got you involved in this Fringe Festival concept, Linda?
I'm a theater freak.
Thomas Adams' first kiss and his lifelong love of photography happened more than 50 years ago.
Museums, theaters, music, anything that piques our interest. You can let NHPR listeners know about your event by becoming an underwriter. To learn about marketing your business on NHPR, visit the business support page at nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members N. Cowan & Sellers and Peterson's Real Estate, affiliates of Lyon & Davis, specializing in fine New Hampshire properties. Information at lyonanddavis.com. And New Hampshire Magazine, featuring New Hampshire as a hotbed of inventions, plus Space Shuttle Challenger 25 years later. New Hampshire Magazine, where New Hampshire comes to you. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, the future of REGI. That's the Northeast's Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. Email us your questions before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, it's the Socrates Exchange, and this month we're pondering the question, are human beings violent by nature? Our philosopher this month is Ed McGushin, professor of philosophy at St. Anselm College. And on the line with us before the break was Sheila in Ringe. And Sheila, you were talking about how at your school, the Meeting School in Ringe, you teach nonviolence. And Ed, I know you wanted to jump in there with Sheila, so go right ahead.
Yes, Sheila, thanks. I find this a very important topic. You know, a week from today, it's going to be Martin Luther King Day. And I had that in the back of my mind with this topic because he's always been kind of a hero of mine for his commitment to nonviolence, which does come off as kind of an extreme thing, I think, in society as a way of handling deep-seated conflicts. So my question is, what kind of techniques can one use to teach nonviolence? Is it really possible, or are figures like Martin Luther King or Gandhi or other figures like that historically very extreme and rare examples in your mind?
Well, I think you brought up a really good point, and I think that the first point I would make is the fact that as a society we do see these people as extremes or abhorrent to our society is a case in point right there. Because if you study nonviolence, the history of nonviolence, you can see that it's been used basically as long as violence has been used. There have also been people who have also been practicing different approaches to things. And we don't study that enough, and we tend to isolate these people that are the prime examples and say, oh, well, you know, there's only one Martin Luther King in a million, you know, and that's just not the case. I mean, each of us in our lives uses nonviolence every day. We use it in many different ways. We don't fight over what kind of pizza we're going to have. We talk it out, you know. So that's the first thing, is to understand that nonviolent reactions to things are just as common and can be practiced more and more if we focus on those things.
So part of the problem, if you want to put it, I guess the problem of violence is that we tend to focus on these extremes. You know, the dramatic instances of violence get our attention, and there's something captivating about them. And dramatic instances of nonviolence.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to ask you something, Sheila.
Sure.
Earlier we spoke with UNH Professor Ted Kirkpatrick. I'm not sure if you heard that, but he studies this issue, and he made the point that in the right circumstances, he argued, even Mother Teresa could be made to be violent. So I wonder what you think of that, and are we all equal in our tendencies to be violent or nonviolent?
Well, in the program that I mentioned at the beginning, Alternatives to Violence Project, that's taught in prisons. It's also taught outside of prisons too. But in that program, we emphasize looking at our capacity for violence. That everybody has that capacity, but it's the choices that we make that can make a difference. It's not that I am, because I get confronted with this all the time because I have such a strong commitment to nonviolence. People always say, "Oh yeah, but if you're child was right, you know, getting harmed right in front of you, wouldn't you choose to be violent to try to stop that?" And I usually say, well, probably I would, but my hope would be that I could come up with something, particularly, you know, some techniques that I've learned that would undo or de-escalate the situation.
All right. Well, Sheila, it's great to hear from you. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks, Sheila.
Bye-bye. You know, Ed, for more insight into this question of are human beings violent by nature, our executive producer, Keith Shields, had a great conversation with Steven Pinker. He's a professor in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University. His forthcoming book is The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. And in it, Pinker looks at how our concept of violence has evolved over time.
There's always enough violence to fill the evening news, and if you get your impression of how violent a society is by how many acts of bloodshed you see on the news, you'll think that we're living in times that are as violent as ever, perhaps even more violent, because we can send camera crews to any godforsaken place to cover a riot or civil war or an act of terrorism. But if you count the number of acts of violence as a proportion of the number of people who are around, it's lower than it ever has been. The rate of homicide is probably 30 to 50 times lower than it was in the Middle Ages, at least in parts of the world where we have statistics. The incidence of war between big, powerful, developed nations has gone way down since the end of the Second World War. And we see the disappearance of barbaric practices that used to be commonplace. executing people for trivial infractions like criticizing the king or stealing a loaf of bread. And when people are executed, it used to be by the most painful, slow, horrific method possible, like burning at the stake or disemboweling or crucifixion. Now, executions are rare, and when they occur, there's a constant debate over how to make it as painless as possible. One reason that violence has decreased is that we have taken retaliation and revenge out of the hands of individuals who always think that they're on the side of the angels and that the other guy is an evildoer, and we've put it into the hands of more or less disinterested third parties, namely the government, the police, and the court system. That prevents acts of violence from spiraling into vendettas and blood feuds. Another reason that violence has gone down is that people have more opportunities to get rich in cooperative ways by trading things and buying what you need from the other guy instead of invading him and stealing it from him. And I think a third reason is that people have expanded their sense of empathy and of universalism, of imagining that they could be in the other guy's place. And so when it comes down to it, torturing, killing, and stealing aren't a very good way of organizing your affairs if it could be me as the victim as often as him. And with literacy and travel and cosmopolitanism, it tends to expand your circle of empathy and rights, and you treat more and more other people the way you want them to treat you. The decline of violence, I think, has profound implications. One of them is it rehabilitates old-fashioned corny concepts like progress and modernity and civilization and enlightenment. In the last 30 or 40 years, people have gotten cynical about the fruits of Western progress, figuring that they may give us iPods and central heating and flush toilets, but they also give us war and terrorism and genocide. But when you crunch the numbers and you see that, in fact, war and terrorism and genocide have gone down, you realize that not only do we have the iPods, but we are less likely to be slain and raped and murdered than our ancestors were. So this suggests that modernity has been an extremely good thing. The question, are humans violent by nature? We obviously have inclinations toward violence. When your computer doesn't do what you want, you're apt to resort to what the technicians sometimes call percussive maintenance. We all are likely to blow our stack, to fantasize about killing people we don't like, to enjoy watching violence vicariously and in murder mysteries and hockey games and Mel Gibson movies. But we're less and less apt to translate those impulses into action. So we have impulses toward violence, but we also have impulses toward self-control, toward reason, toward empathy, and we're just exercising some parts of our human nature more than others, even if the human nature itself has not changed. I have been impressed at how big a role ideas have played in the decline of violence, and this obviously ties into the theme of the program, namely philosophy. It has been, to a very large extent, Enlightenment-era philosophers who came up with ideas that led to the decline of violence that we enjoy now. Arguments against slavery and torture, arguments about how to have a government that can reduce feuding and raiding among its citizens, ideas about how you can reduce warfare without turning us into a nicer species, reinforcing the idea that ideas and philosophy are not just words, but can improve people's lives for the better and by a lot.
That conversation with Professor Steven Pinker was produced by Exchange Executive Producer Keith Shields. Join us for our latest Socrates Exchange today on the question, are human beings violent by nature? Ed McGushin is with me, and Ed, let's go right back to our callers. Christopher's waiting in Tilton. Hi, Christopher, thanks for hanging on. Go ahead, you're on the Socrates Exchange.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for getting me on the air this morning. Appreciate it. I'm a corrections officer in New Hampshire. I try and reinforce positive behavior, rewarding positive behavior in the facility. And there's just one thing I found inherent with the ultra-violent offenders I've spoken to. Every one of them has always had a huge, huge issue with either not having parents or having parents that didn't pay any attention to them. And they lash out on society. And they've told me that no one else will listen, and this is the only thing that people listen to is violence.
Wow.
I just found that very interesting. And once they've gotten to this point, they seem to have been desensitized to the things they've done and don't believe there's any repercussions for any actions they take. Because nothing could be worse than what they've already been through.
Wow. Wow, it's a lot, isn't it, Christopher? Go ahead, Ed.
Yeah.
Christopher, there are a lot of different points that you raised there, different questions that you raised there. I mean, one with the sort of familial background that you seem to be noticing there, it seems like maybe there's a sense in which there's a lack of recognition from others, important others in their lives. Is that what you're getting at, that they crave some or miss some sense?
Yeah,
that
they're missing attention. Every single one I've spoken to, because I have a good rapport with inmates I work with. I'm fair with them, consistent, and I'm able to get them down to a comfortable level and speak with me about things that they normally wouldn't speak to other people about. And that's the information I've been getting from every one of them. It always roots back to some kind of parental issue.
So, Christopher, are human beings violent by nature? You seem to be saying no, it's a parental thing.
I don't know if it's completely parental. I think that is bringing out a deep-rooted violence by nature. I mean, I think that the violence by nature can be deterred, per se, with certain, psychological, I guess you wouldn't say conditioning, but conditions that you're raised with. But I think when some things go astray, such as such a strong thing as lack of parenting or lack of parents, I think it brings it out in people.
So, Christopher, can violence be reversed? Like you said, that you try to talk to people and, listen to them?
I believe it can, but unfortunately in our society, people of that nature of special needs, no one's helping them. Even in the prison system and the jail systems, they have mental health, and it's so understaffed and so slow in progress that people slip through the cracks, and then they only get addressed. It's very reactive, not a proactive system.
All right. Well, Christopher, real interesting to hear from you, given, again, your perspective as a corrections officer. Thanks for being on the Socrates Exchange. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
I want to share with you, we got lots of great postings, Ed, on our website on this. Here's one from Kaya who says, I believe everyone is born with some inherent evil, some more than others, but nevertheless, all of us. Kaya says the whole world is incapable of being completely nonviolent, clearly because everyone has that evil to be violent towards one another. Kaya says we can all hope to be like Gandhi and Martin Luther King, but realistically, she says, it's just not impossible. That reminds me of our earlier conversation with Sheila, so I wanted to share that posting with you. Let's take one more call, if we could, Ed. This is Phil in Bradford. Hi, Phil. You're on the Socrates Exchange.
Hi, Laura. Thanks for having me. The earlier discussion seemed to center on killing as being violent, and I want to make the observation that I don't think killing is inherently violent. When I think of someone in food production, like a gardener or a butcher, I don't think of the killing they do as violent. I think violent is, violence is something different altogether.
Hey, Phil, thanks for the call. And I think this gets on to a really interesting and important topic that might take us back a little bit to Steven Pinker's interesting analysis. So food production, I mean, if you looked at the, say a butcher, if you looked at the act of butchering from the animal's perspective, it would probably
sure.
Look pretty violent, right?
Yeah, I would guess so.
I mean, so I guess what I want to get out with that is that it might be violent without being, as the commenter Kaya said, evil. Can we make a distinction so that there may be violence in case—
intent.
Yeah, so while that's where it starts to get a little difficult maybe, if we can make a distinction between violence, like say a butcher butchering an animal or a gardener pulling up a plant— and then something else that's more cruel or malicious. So that goes from a kind of violence to an evil, a maliciousness that's more than just what one of our earlier callers was talking about as a sort of necessary or a kind of justified violence.
Yeah. I guess if you think of it as when a butcher kills an animal, it's for the benefit of others. You might be able to differentiate. Even when a psychopath commits murder, he may think he's benefiting himself, but is there any benefit to the greater society? I mean, is there any way to define it that way with the amount of good that comes from an action and the number of people that it benefits?
So you could look at it in terms of the consequences or the benefits that it brings, but maybe you could also look at it another way. What is the way in which the person butchers the ant? So how do they carry that out?
that can be violent.
Sure, it can be, and it can be, you know, there's a difference between maybe a farmer, a family farm who butchers an animal that he's raised, you know, and a large factory farm where the animals have been, you know, confined, have been force-fed foods that they are not evolved to eat, where they've been pumped full of antibiotics. I wondered, would you see a difference between that kind of butchering of an animal and, you know, the small farmer who you know, who's raised the sheep himself or herself?
Maybe. I mean, there could be. I mean, there are elements of violence in, you know, if you put value on the maliciousness or on the way that animals are raised, yes. But I mean, if you think about a line worker, you know, who's cutting animals apart, you know, in production style, they can go to work and not have an ounce of anger or violence in them. They're just going to work for a paycheck. They may be trying to feed a family of four or something, you know, with a meager income that they get from it. And I wouldn't think they'd be violent.
Okay. Phil, thanks a lot for being with us on the Socrates Exchange today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Phil.
And Ed, next month the question will be, can one person be better than another? Our guest philosopher will not be you, it'll be Max Latona, but can you just give us a quick sneak preview, Ed, of some of the discussion surrounding that question?
Well, it's a big question for a democracy where our government is premised on the idea of all men or all human beings are created equal. So is that really true, and in what sense is that true? Obviously, before the law, we're equal, but in other respects, we're very obviously unequal. And how deep does that go?
All right, we'll have fun with that. And a reminder that Ed will continue this conversation online for the next hour. So keep your thoughts coming in. Go to the Socrates Exchange page at nhpr.org and continue the discussion there with Ed McGushin. And Ed, it's been really nice to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Laura.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Funding for the Socrates Exchange is made possible in part by the New Hampshire Humanities Council. Our engineer is Will Roselip, Dan Colgan, the producer is Will Roselip, our volunteers Priscilla Malcolm, our intern is Ryan Lessard, the executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org. The Exchange celebrates its 15th anniversary season with support from Bank of America, committed to serving New Hampshire's communities.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, Reggie hits a rocky road. Several years ago, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative formed as a coalition of 10 northeastern states, including New Hampshire. It was aimed at reducing carbon dioxide through a cap-and-trade system. Over time, it's had its challenges, and now a legislative proposal would pull the Granite State out completely. We'll find out why and what other states may do with Reggie. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.